Coming up on this week's show, a classic Sega franchise is getting a comedy TV series.
The most impressive Atari ST racer we've ever seen.
And we celebrate 40 years of the Amstrad CPC with Roland Perry.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen their latest volume celebrating the Nintendo 64? N64, a visual compendium, tells the story of the console that changed the gaming world, covering more than 150 titles that defined that system. We'll tell you more about that in just a bit. Meanwhile, check it out on the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 425, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And very nice to have you joining us for the podcast that every single Friday takes you on a nostalgic trip back to the golden age of video games, exploring the games, the systems that we all grew up playing with, and of course, bringing it up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro from over the last 7 days. Because if you are new to the podcast, that's kind of what we do. First half, bit of a roundtable chat with us guys about what's been happening in retro over the last week, and then the second half of the show, I think, is, you know, to me, where this podcast really comes into its own. No offense, guys. Not that I don't love chatting to you guys about what's been happening in retro, but I think when we get the guests on to tell their story, that for me is like just the reason, you know, to get out of bed and do this podcast in the morning. I mean, that was the reason that we initially set this podcast up, to record stories forever.
Get fantastic stories told. And, you know, this week, well, we're talking about a great company. You know, there was a lot of British computer systems back in the days, but Amstrad was absolutely everywhere. I remember seeing even in the hi-fi world, you know, Amstrad hi-fis, they had Amstrad TVs.
CB radios, I remember them.
Yeah, all sorts. And, you know, my first machine was actually a PC 1512, and that was a PC clone, CGA machine. You know, I absolutely adored that. And it's really interesting because they also had the CPC, which is just hitting its 40th anniversary, actually.
Yeah, because it was last Friday, the Amstrad CPC turned 40, which to me, like, you know, it seems like every week or we're talking about, you know, a certain game or a certain company that are celebrating 30th, even 40th anniversaries, which I must admit doesn't make me feel quite old. But yeah, I've got memories of being at school. My friend Graham, he had an Amstrad CPC, and I've got vivid memories of going around there playing Ghostbusters on his Amstrad, and he had the green screen monitor.
Yeah, my friend Kim had one as well, and the green screen monitor as well, and we used to sit there, and it was really a unique system. And, you know, we've started to see a lot of kind of titles coming out recently that are really, you know, taking control of the power of the Amstrad and really pushing it, where a lot of titles didn't so much back in the days.
That is one thing I always remember. Because, I mean, there were obviously some titles that I think did take advantage of the Amstrad. I always remember looking at, you know, when you'd buy a game on cassette tape and you'd look at the back at the screenshots.
Yeah.
I always remember a lot of those, the Amstrad screenshots always looked the best to me. A lot of the time I'd look at them, they look better than the C64 or the Commodore Plus 4 that I had at the time. You know, the Amstrad often beat that in terms of screenshots. But I mean, yeah, it was like, I think you're right. It was, in many ways, it was a bit of an untapped system, because back then there were a lot of kind of lazy ports of Spectrum games that were kind of just ported over to the Amstrad. But in recent years, you're right, there have been, you know, efforts like, you know, teams like the Batman Group that we talked about, who've did that incredible port of Pinball Fantasies to the Amstrad. Yeah. A lot of other titles like that are coming along that really show that, you know, people still love this machine and have took the time to learn the hardware over the last 40 years and are really making it sing. And it does kind of feel like the Amstrad scene is becoming a little bit more celebrated now, because it wasn't only a big system here in the UK, but also particularly Spain.
They hit that European market, didn't they? And it's really good to see, you know, a renewed interest. I work with Pixel Addict, and they actually did Amstrad Addict, which was a special edition of the magazine recently to celebrate the system, because I know there's a lot of love still there. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are also making new devices for it, add-ons, and I've seen, like, even Amstrad themed keyboards.
Yeah, and like you said, I love that issue of Amstrad Addict magazine as well. It's kind of, it's a one-off collector's edition of Amstrad Addict. 60 pages, basically a bit of a sum up of what's happening in the world of Amstrad now. Some, you know, classic and new game reviews in there as well. There's even a type-in basic program in there too. Even an interview with Lord Sugar in there too. So if you want to get hold of that, I mean, I'll link that up in the show notes as well. That's still available to buy. But this week we are going to be celebrating the Amstrad CPC's 40th birthday in, I think, the best possible way, because we've got someone who was integral to that machine back in the day. We're going to be talking to Roland Perry.
Yeah, but Roland Perry, I've wanted to have on the show, you know, since we've started. And you may remember the games, Roland, the game character on the Amstrad, you know, on Amsoft.
Roland on the Run, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They were actually named after him in a kind of joke by Alan Sugar. And, you know, he was integral to getting the CPC released, getting it out there, getting it popular, getting stuff like the paperwork, the documentation in there, and, you know, enabling a lot of people to have that system. And also a lot of the decisions that happened with Amstrad happened with Roland. And, it, you know, in this first part of the interview, we're going to be talking about the kind of start, the early days, his history and his background. Then we're going to be doing a second part of the interview, which has stuff about, you know, the merger with Sinclair when they acquired Sinclair, also, you know, prototypes that happened, a lot of interesting information.
Yeah, because we didn't want to cut this interview down. We recorded well over an hour with Roland.
Yeah.
And it would have been either we could put out like a 2-hour podcast, which looking at our stats, most people seem to prefer the hour-ish kind of mark.
Yeah, we always push it anyway. Yeah, so yeah, exactly, 2 hours.
The retro 2 hours might be kind of pushing it a bit too far. But yeah, so what we're going to do is, like Ravi said, we're going to run this in two parts today. The initial concept, you know, how Roland got into it and when he was taking the initial prototype around companies, because this whole project was actually done insanely in about 3 months.
That's mad by even like today's standards, getting something done that quickly, let alone back then, you know.
Yeah, so if you've got any interest at all in the legendary Amstrad CPC, definitely hang around. Roland Perry, part one of the interview is coming up on the show in around 35 minutes from now. I will just say, though, if you get into it and you're thinking, oh, I'd love to hear the whole thing now, we're going to put the full thing out for our patrons this week as well. So a little treat for you there as well, if you want to join that, all the details at theretrohour.com. So celebrating the Amstrad CPC 40th anniversary in the next half an hour. Before that, of course, this is where we have a bit of a geek out about what's been happening in retro from over the last week. Now, you were saying before, Joe, that it just kind of feel like recently we've been a bit spoiled in terms of video game TV shows. I know you enjoyed The Last of Us. I think you watched the whole thing of that, didn't you? You got well into that show.
Yeah, I really enjoyed The Last of Us. I was going into work every Monday and talking to my boss about that, like, oh, did you watch it? Oh, do you remember when that happened in the game? I know you guys weren't as keen on it as I was.
I mean, I kind of feel like, I mean, to be fair, it took me about 4 attempts to get into Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
I'd love that by the end. So maybe I just need to give it more.
I've been more into the movies, like the history style ones, like, you know, Blackberry was really good.
Yeah,
and,
you
Tetris
really,
as well.
Tetris, you really enjoyed that, didn't you? I remember you saying it was like one of the best films ever. But yeah, you know, video game adaptations have been really good recently. I've not watched Fallout yet, but I'm seeing a lot of good stuff about that. Mm. And nice to see a resurgence in people playing the games as well. Obviously, the Super Mario movie, obviously a children's film, but, you know, everybody said it's absolutely fantastic. Sonic was pretty good as well. But this one that's caught my eye this week, it feels a bit strange. So it's been announced, and at first I definitely thought this was an April Fool's. Yeah. When I spotted this a couple of days ago, and I was like, no, we're mid-April. This isn't an April Fool's. And it's being reported on by, you know, all the big hitters now. And Golden Axe animated TV series coming to us from Comedy Central. Golden Axe, like, yeah, me and Dan love it. Like, huge, you know, huge game for us. But it just seems like such an odd choice. Like, am I missing something? Golden Axe hasn't been relevant for a long time. And I'm like, have I missed a recent release?
They are
of this
doing
game,
Dragon's Lair, the movie with Ryan Reynolds. It's in production. So, you know, these older franchises and stuff, they seem to be taking them on board.
Yeah. You're right, though, because to me, this does feel like a strange direction to take a franchise like Golden Axe Inc. I mean, obviously it was a, you know, a hack and slash game back in the day. And actually, you know, the characters in it, you know, got them skeletons and stuff like that. It's a pretty scary game, pretty creepy. And you could probably make a kind of an epic fantasy series out of that.
Conan the Barbarian stuff.
Something like that would work well. But it turns out actually the writers on this are people whose pedigree is stuff like American Dad and Star Trek The Lower Decks. And the fact that it's going to be aired on Comedy Central would, strongly suggest to me that this is going to be kind of a comedy TV show along the lines of something like American Dad, which seems very bizarre for Golden Axe.
Yeah, I can only assume it's going to be a comedy. Coming from Comedy Central and the people who are going to be writing it and producing it. And Sega are on board. You know, the CEOs of Sega Sammy and Sega Corporation are going to be the executive producers of the show, which is, you know, nice to see Sega, you know, licensing it and all that jazz. Actor-wise, I've not heard of any of the actors who are playing.
We've been looking through, haven't we, trying to look at their pedigree.
Yeah.
There's one guy, Danny Puddy, who apparently was the voice of Huey on the reboot of DuckTales.
Okay.
So, yeah, all right. That's about the only thing I've heard of. Any of them have done, but...
And he's going to be playing a character called Hampton Squibb, who... is an inexperienced and underprepared, you know, part of the story. So I'm assuming he's going to be the comedy relief. But what's nice to see is the adaptation is going to include the classic characters. So it is Axe Battler, Tyrus Flair, Gilius Thunderhead, Death Adder is the bad guy, you know. Mm. So it's cool to see that it is based on what Golden Axe was. You know, they're not like, hopefully they're not going to try and make this crazy, like, you know, story about all these different characters and everything that we've
maybe
never heard
they're going to go like a total mick take of like He-Man and these kind of, you know, like a campy older 80s fantasy things, and maybe approach it from that one, or do like taking a mick out of video games. I don't know. Yeah. Weird that it is Comedy Central.
Yeah, I think you could be right there. I mean, I like American Dad. I've not watched it in a very long time, but early American Dad, I actually prefer to Family Guy because obviously it was the same team. I've not watched the other shows that the producers are from, the writers are from, Star Trek Lower Decks and Solar Opposites.
Ravi wasn't a fan of that one, because you know you're a big Trekker.
Yeah. I watched a few episodes. I wasn't a huge fan of that, but there's so much Star Trek, it's hard to find stuff that you like, you know.
Fair enough. But yeah, it's I mean, I'm for it. I'll watch it.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It's just, I know what you're saying, Ravi, about the whole Dragon's Lair and Ryan Reynolds and stuff, but I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I feel like Dragon's Lair is more within pop culture. Like it's bigger. Like it's more well-remembered than Golden Axe. I don't know. I could be wrong. You know, maybe there's a lot more Golden Axe fans out there than I think. Or is it all, you know, strategic play on the re-release, the remakes of the games that Sega are currently doing, which has been a bit quiet recently?
Well, I wonder how long it's going to be as well. Like, are they just going to do 6 episodes? That'll be it. Like, you know, obviously
it's 10 episodes apparently.
Yeah, like American Dad has run for seasons, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know, yeah. So, Family Guy's like 22 seasons.
How much
seasons
life can you get out of it? Yeah.
Can you imagine that if Golden Axe kind of became like the new American Dad on your Family Guy? Yeah,
in 20 years' time, there's like season 20 of Golden Axe.
That'd be the strangest twist.
What hijinks does Axe Battler get up to this week?
Well, we said stuff on this podcast that's happened.
This is true.
That we've always thought.
This is true.
So you never know.
Yeah, I think you're right there, Joe. I think, you know, I'll watch it. It's going to be interesting to see what they do with it. In a way, I'm kind of, you know, it is interesting that they're not going to be going down the predictable kind of route and they are trying something different, which could be a great thing, or it could blow up in the face spectacularly.
Yeah.
No release date is yet, but it looks like, you know, production is getting started on that soon. So we'll keep an eye on that. Now, this is always good news to read, particularly in this age where we're always reading about, you know, digital is like the future and physical games are phasing out and shops are closing down, all that kind of thing. Turns out that Microsoft, though, are taking preservation of backward compatibility seriously, because they've now got a dedicated team to ensure that classic games will live on for future generations.
Yeah, I was reading this earlier on. So Microsoft Xbox, they've released like a plan, like a roadmap of like what the kind of future looks like. And obviously it's not like straight up, here's the next Xbox, here's what games we're porting, because obviously they've been in the news a lot recently, of you know, announcing that they're going to be porting some of their AAA titles, you know, to other consoles.
Yeah.
And we still don't really 100% know what that looks like, as far as I'm aware.
There's all those rumors about Game Pass might end up on the PlayStation.
Yeah, exactly. But in a recent, and obvious, you know, interviews and documentations and stuff, people have been going through Sarah Bond, who is, I want to say, is she the CEO of Xbox?
Xbox president, is she?
She's been talking about preservation of, you know, classic games. So she doesn't say retro games, but of classic games. And obviously Xbox have, you know, ever since the Xbox 360, you know, been doing backwards compatibility. And I think as each generation of Xbox has come out, the next console's come out, it's got slightly better each time to a point now where quite a lot, if not all of the Xbox Series X is backwards compatible, I think.
I think it's been a bit further than that. So like, you know, a lot of the LAN matches you've been able to, I've seen at retro shows, I've seen, you know, nearly every generation of Xbox all connected together playing Halo. You know, it's had that compatibility. But then you also need to remember that the Xbox world bridges over to the PC as well. So there's, you know, they have cross compatibility with some of the games where you've got PC gamers playing with people that are also using consoles as well at the same time. So, you know, it's a huge range of kind of titles that can be applied to like both systems as well.
And it's interesting to see, but yeah, they are launching a dedicated team to preserve the backwards compatibility of these games, which is what the actual news is, you know, they're saying there is going to be a team who are dedicated to making sure this all still works.
Which I think is a good thing. I mean, there have been, we've read stories before about them saying, right, here's a list of games, the backwards compatibility program's finished now for a while. They've said that before, haven't they? But it seems like they're all back in on it now.
Yeah, they definitely seem all back in it on it. And I think maybe they're seeing it as a bit of a gap in the market because of this article on Retro Dodo definitely throws shade towards Nintendo and PlayStation without saying it, because it's like, oh, other big companies have shut their servers down all of a sudden for their, you know, older, you know, consoles, and obviously they're throwing shade at the Wii U and the PS3 store and all kind of that kind of stuff. And yeah, maybe Xbox are seeing that kind of gap of like, well, we'll keep it going and people will still, you know, obviously they're not making any money off the old games because they're all secondhand, etc. They're not selling, you know, Halo and Brute Force and Need for Speed and stuff like that.
They're putting them on Game Pass, aren't they?
And, you know, I guess they're seeing it,
which
as
is
like,
getting signups, you know.
You're right. It's getting signups. And I guess it's maybe the more I think about it now, like, because they're struggling with system sellers, there's no Halo and Gears of War used to be like they were the system sellers for Xbox, but they're just not pulling the same kind of numbers.
GTA.
Well, that's going to be on everything, isn't it? But they're not pulling, the exclusives aren't pulling the same numbers that PlayStation and Nintendo exclusives were probably pulling. So maybe they're just looking at that gap in the market and like going, okay, well, Xbox, let's get back to our roots. It's an all-around console. It still plays all the old games. It still plays the new games. You know, here's the draw of it can do everything. It doesn't just play the place, you know, like a PlayStation 5. Yeah. It just plays PlayStation 5 games other than the online stuff that you can download. So,
and then there's also talk of, you know, the biggest technical leap ever in a generation, and talk of AI and stuff like that. And I was thinking about it, and, you know, we've always had AI in games. You know, when you have a computer player, when you have a bot, like, I don't know how they would implement AI further. You know, it's always been part of, like, gaming for me.
I think what they mean with that AI thing, we're going off on a tangent here, but what I think there is... when they're saying, like, you know, they're going to implement AI into the next Xboxes, I think the games are going to, you know, these roguelike dungeon games where you, these dungeon crawlers, which are roguelike, so every time you play it, it's
be like
different.
More adaptive. Like,
they adapt and it's always something different. I think that's what they mean with that, like with
AI.
Fair,
everything has got to have AI in its marketing. I saw on Amazon the other day a toaster that said it had AI built in.
Oh, fantastic.
To perfectly warm your bread to the right temperature.
With ChatGPT.
You know? But yeah, I think you had a good point there, Joe. I think to me, this does kind of reek as a bit of a marketing kind of effort, because we have seen before that, you know, I think they did release some stats a while ago, didn't they? Maybe 2 or 3 years ago, that it was something like less than 5% of current Xbox owners actually use the backwards compatibility of their systems. So it's not getting widely used, but I think there's probably a bit of comfort there that people know that they can if they want to, because the Xbox is the only system I know of, you know, you can't do this with the PlayStation, where I can literally put an Xbox 360 disc into my Xbox Series X and play the game. I mean, admittedly, it's all it does is it fetches it off Xbox Live and downloads it to the system. But basically, you don't need to buy it again or search it in the store. The act of, you know, having your physical game, being able to put it in your new machine and being able to play the game is unique to Xbox. You know, it's nothing that you can do on the PlayStation 5.
Yeah.
So, and I do play some. I mean, we do play a few of the old Call of Duties still on the modern Xbox. And I'll dig out, you know, Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 or 3, like the original ones. You know, my brother and I sometimes have a blast of those. So it is something that I do occasionally use. And I do think that kind of, because it is pretty much a full Xbox 360 emulator that's built in, isn't it? You know, when you put a 360 game in, it launches into the 360 environment. It's got the 360 dashboard and, you know, the settings and all that. It's all in there. So, you know, the compatibility is really good. So I think it is a good thing. I do wonder how many people will use it. I mean, you know, even going back to, you can get original Xbox games on Game Pass.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I wonder how many people are sitting there and playing 20 plus old games on their latest system. Then again, it is something that I do. So, you know, I can't be unique in that, I imagine.
Yeah, but you guys got like the Xboxes to play the retro games. Yeah,
I mean, this is true.
Yeah. I mean, there is part of that. If I was to, if I wanted the full kind of original Halo experience, I would, you know, if I could be bothered, I'd rather fish my original Xbox out and hook it up to a CRT and play with a Duke controller. But I appreciate not everyone, you know, is insane enough to go to those efforts. So, yeah, I do think that's a good thing. And I think any big company that is actually putting game preservation front and center, even if it is just for marketing, I think is definitely a good thing. So, yeah, props to Microsoft. We'll keep an eye on that. Now, this is a platform that doesn't seem to get much attention in retro these days. And it is good to see that it is, though, because I think this is a seriously under-tapped machine. We're talking about the Atari ST-E. Now, that is the enhanced Atari ST model that came out, when was that, 1989, I want to say, I think the Atari ST-E came out. Had a few nice enhancements. I think it had like 4,096 colours in there that kind of, you know, brought it on par with the Amiga in terms of the colour palette on there. I remember it had a blitter on board as well, had improved audio, had those analog joystick ports on there as well that I don't think were all that widely used, but it was a nice addition. You had SIM slots to expand the memory of it as well. So it was quite a nice little upgrade, but obviously, like any of these systems, generally the software houses would rather just write a program that would work on a 512K Atari ST that would also work on the STE and not actually shrink the market, which makes sense. But it is also nice when you see projects coming along that actually do take advantage of the on-tap power in these systems. And how smooth does this new racing game look that we've now got a demo of?
Yeah, this looks really good. And, you know, I've got an ST here next to me.
Is yours an STE or is it an original?
Original one. And yeah, I've always wanted an STE and always kind of wanted to play on one. And I've not seen that many exclusive titles. Like, I'm going to admit it, I'm fairly new to the ST world. So I have been going through and playing some of the games and stuff. And I've kind of been looking for these like massive exclusives that are out there. And it's good to see that people are making, you know, exclusives that are just going to really hit the system, because a lot of them have been ports off other systems as well. We've seen a few games developed like Dread that came out on the Amiga as well that had an ST version and stuff, and that's good that both communities are kind of benefiting each other. But I think this looks really good, and this looks like it's just totally targeted at it, and it's, you know, taking advantage of all of the kind of enhancements that were in that machine.
Yeah, so this is a it's kind of an untitled game at the moment. Its working title is Atari STE 50 FPS Racer, and that is really the selling point of this. Now, it looks like it is a very nice kind of Lotus Turbo Challenge, Outrun-style game, But the thing about it is, whereas, you know, the Atari ST did famously or infamously get a pretty dreadful Outrun port back in the day, which I think was the same one that we played on the Amiga Revy, which I'm sure most people have booted that up, still got nightmares about. But yeah, this looks like a really nice upgrade to those classic racing games. It really does take advantage of the enhancements in the STE and does run at a buttery smooth 50 frames a second. Now, at the moment, there is just a little, it's kind of a 1 minute video.
It's kind of like a little tech demo, isn't it?
But what do you think of that?
There's no sound. You know, they've got a nice kind of a gradient, like copper effect on the top. The pixel art looks all right. There's not that many kind of, you know, things on the road or at the side, but as a proof of concept and as a consistent frame rate, it does look good, and it looks like something that can really develop.
Well, I know, Joe, you're not all that experienced with the Atari ST. Have you ever actually played an ST before?
Nope.
There you go. I've got a feeling there is going to be some at Ravi's Amiga events, so I might have to sit you down in front of one, get your thoughts.
Got to get you around, Joe, and get you on the ST.
I've got an Atari STE, and I've got to admit there are a few games where, you know, the sound might be a little bit better, but I haven't really played any titles that take advantage of it. What do you think, Joe, of this demo then, in terms of, you know, being like a classic arcade racer? Do you think this looks nice?
I think it looks nice. I think it looks good. Jonathan Thomas, who's made this, he points out, looking at other games in a similar vein, such as Super Hang-On, you know, by Sega, you know, likes the way that the bikes, that he says, you know, the bikes are in the distance, they slow down so you can catch up, but then they speed up again when you catch up with them. Like, it's, you know, the AI in it, you know, it's not kind of like optimized, and it makes the game really tough. And I always found the games such as, you know, Lotus Challenge and, you know, Top Gear and Hang On, all those games, you know, I always thought they looked really cool, but I always found them really, really tough. And watching these couple of minutes that he's put out there, it seems a lot more. This is going to really sound like a really stupid word to say, because obviously this game is kind of a proof of concept at the moment, but accessible. You know, if this was a game that you just kind of put into my hands and go and play, you know, it makes you feel good, because you're like, yeah, I'm winning kind of thing. Like it looks, I don't want to say easier, but it just looks more realistic in a sense, if that makes sense. Like the cars don't just slow down and then they speed up all of a sudden, and just, you know, like F-Zero is a good example where cars would just fly around you at a million miles an hour and go faster than what you could ever drive.
You haven't driven on the M1 on a Friday night.
Well, yeah. But yeah, I think it just looks a lot more, you know, sit down and play it and like enjoy it. But what that might create when this does become a full game is a kind of, you play it through once and complete it and never play it again, because there might not be enough of a challenge. So it's kind of about building that balance as well. But graphically, I think it looks really good.
Yeah, I mean, you've even got the day to night element of it as well in this demo. I mean, it's a minute long and it kind of, you know, the sky gets dark and it goes into night mode.
Yeah.
Which I think is very, I always love seeing that in games back in the day when it suddenly goes nighttime and it's like, wow, look at that. And I think, it looks beautiful. In many ways, it does remind me of like a game running on a Sega machine. I don't know if it just goes to that great frame rate that makes
he's
it.
He's got some extra stuff and effects. If you like, look on his Twitter. You know, if you're going off the track, it starts to rumble and the screen shakes and stuff. So there's all these like little effects that he's using and adding in. And I think, you know, if this gets released and it's like boxed and stuff, I think people will go mad for it.
Yeah, well, you know, Jonathan's got some serious pedigree as well. He actually worked on the Atari ST version of a Pole Position, and he was part of the team which ported Gremlin's Lotus to the ST as well.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, obviously having in-depth knowledge of those games, I imagine, is definitely helping with this. So I think it looks awesome. And I think, you know, it is nice to see software coming out that takes advantage of hardware that didn't get enough love back in the day. Because there's nothing worse, is it? You know, it even frustrated me buying like an AGA Amiga, you know, the lack of AGA games that came out back in the day. You're like, well, what have I forked all this extra money for if I'm still just playing Amiga 500 games? You know, so all you have to do is wait 30 years and people finally give you what you want. So we'll keep an eye on that. And if you want to check out the video so far, I will link that in the show notes as well. Now, some more exciting news for Evercade owners. Feels like we're talking about the Evercade quite a lot again recently. A lot of nice new collections coming out, including this one. This is going to be the Tomb Raider Collection 1 pack. Now, this is a Giga Cart, which I imagine means it's going to weigh in over a gigabyte in size on the cartridge. Basically, you've got the first three PlayStation 1 games nicely bundled on a cartridge that you can play in the comfort of your palm on your Evercade.
It's Tomb Raider mania at the moment, you know, because obviously we got the remasters about a month ago, and now we're getting the you know, the Tomb Raider collection, which aren't the remasters, they are the PlayStation 1 versions, but, you know, nicely all in one place on the Giga Cart. And it's nice to see the Evercade still going, you know, strength to strength. Now, is this a new, there's not a new version of the Evercade, this is still on the original.
Yeah, it's, I think it's just a cart that you can, that's basically got more room on it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's crazy that, you know, the Evercade's kind of like, when I first saw it, it was kind of like, oh yeah, look at these 8-bit games. And then it was like, oh yeah, look at these 16-bit games on there. Yeah. And then the other week we're like, oh, Glover for the N64 is running on it now. Like, that looks great. And now it's like, oh, like, I know Tomb Raider's a 32-bit game, but you're like, okay, it's Tomb Raider's on there now. And you've got three on one cartridge, like, you know, running on there. I think that's absolutely fantastic. And we don't have to wait too long. They're coming out on July 31st. For only £22.49 as well, which I think is a reasonable price for these games. But
yeah, I think that, you know, the cart's going to be easy to do nowadays at that kind of, you know, memory. Yeah, it's nothing groundbreaking, but it is a really cool little collection. And I do think the price is right. You know, this is what Evercade does. You know, it presents to you a nice little package and something that, you know, it picks the games for you. You can put them in, have a go, have a play, and it's better than those kind of endless lists that you're constantly scrolling through on, you know, emulators and stuff like that. Some people really enjoy having it delivered in that way, and I think it's cool that they've announced that they're partnered now with Crystal Dynamics, because that means, you know, other titles might come out, and find it interesting it's the PlayStation 1 version as well that they've gone with.
Yeah, Joe wants a Gex collection. You were playing Gex the other night, weren't you, Ravi? He sent us a
Playing Gex, the N64 one, I think.
It would be nice to see that, because I think, you know, even though we do take the mickey out of Gex.
Pandemonium.
Yeah, collections are quite nice. It is actually quite timely as well, because Evercade have actually announced a couple of days ago they're going to be doing a bit of a refresh of their hardware in July as well, with the Evercade EXPR and the... I never know, is it Versus or VS? I've got the VS. The Evercade VSR, which basically they give it a nice new kind of charcoal look as well. I think the hardware is pretty much identical inside, just a, you know, bit of a slicker looking case, and controversially removed some of the built-in games that came with the original EXP, apparently. And the mini HDMI has been removed, which means you won't be able to connect it to your telly, which I've seen some people being a bit like, ooh. Okay. But then, you know, you can buy the VS if you want a sit-down console experience. But I think, you know, what you said before, Ravi, it is nice that, you know, the VS is still getting so much love and attention, and the fact that they're, you know, doing hardware refreshes and these kind of triple-A game compilations are still being released for it.
I think, you know, if it was a higher price, it wouldn't seem fair. But because you can go and get one of these cheap things off... you know, one of the dodgy sites and have every PlayStation 1 game on it. And, you know, but this is nice that you can have it on the VS and stuff.
And the fact that, you know, Crystal Dynamics are working with them, and, you know, they've got that track record. You know, it's not going to have emulation glitches. It's going to run nicely. It's going to be quality tested. So, you know, that you're going to get a nice quality package. So pre-orders for that are available from the end of this month. And like you said, going to be released on July 31st as well, alongside the revised hardware as well. So if you want to check that out, I will link that in the show notes as well. Now, this story made me giggle a bit when I first saw it. And I was like, well, why would anyone want to do this? But actually, there might be some use cases for this, because now you can use your Game Boy Advance as a controller for your Switch.
This threw me off at first. This is a... I don't want to say simpler, but it's not as complicated as I initially thought. So your Game Boy Advance working on the Switch as a Switch controller. And I was a bit like, when I first read it and before I kind of watched it and kind of, you know, just saw it before I kind of read and watched it, I was like, oh, you know, is this going to be one of the Switch controllers in the Game Boy Advance? Or is this going to, you know, some hacking and there's going to be, the Yoshi game that had the tilt thing in it from Game Boy Advance in there. Yep. But it's not quite as over the top or as complicated as that. It is actually using a device called the GBA TX cart, which is a Bluetooth device that he's created that you can put into your Game Boy Advance. It's like a Game Boy Advance cartridge. And it allows it to connect to any Bluetooth device, you know, so for example, a Switch, PlayStation, you know, an Xbox,
PC, Raspberry Pi,
yeah, kind of thing. So it's just in this video that's been released. It is being played on the Switch, which is fitting because of it's a Nintendo handheld on a Nintendo handheld. And interestingly, it also works on the emulators for iPhone that we were talking about last week on the show that have come out as well.
Can use Bluetooth controllers. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. So essentially what it does is it makes the Game Boy Advance into a Bluetooth controller, very similar to the 8-bit Do controllers, you know, that come out, which are like the little SNES controllers and NES controllers and stuff. But it's a really cool, you know, little gadget.
Apparently it works on the Game Boy Advance, SP, DS, GB Micro and Analog Pocket as well.
Oh, does it? Oh, that's wicked. Yeah. Oh, that is wicked. That is. I didn't think of the other. I was just thinking, you know, because of the image, just classic GBA. I didn't even think of all the different, you know, the DSi and all that, which has got it in the bottom.
And it seems like, you know, I've never been a fan of playing on the screen. You know, touching the screen and the touch buttons. I'd rather have like physical buttons when I'm playing a game. So this is a good way of like, you know, extending the kind of controller to the iPhone. And this emulator Delta has been around for quite a while.
Okay.
But it was a side loading one, so or a jailbreak one. It's now with the acceptance of emulators on the official Apple iOS store. It's now become official, so I think it's getting shone in more of a light. But it also has like custom Game Boy skins on it, so you can actually have like a Game Boy Advance skin. So it looks like you're playing in an Advance, and then you touch on the screen. But it's interesting because I think it's also supported on the iPad now because it's on the iOS store, and I think also maybe the Apple Vision as well, which is pretty mad. But I think this opens up a whole new thing, which is going to be kind of an emulator war on the iPhone because it's such a popular device that so many people have. The emulators are going to start fighting against each other, and I bet you at one point there's going to start to be transactions and microtransactions and all this kind of stuff that's going to come in. And whilst this is being developed, I think the emulators that aren't on this Delta package, someone else will make one as well. And there'll be loads of companies going for it now because they all want that kind of that market of being the iPhone emulator.
I've got to say, for me, I don't really play games on my iPhone.
No, so, I'd see the iPad as something that you could, you know, put up and then have a controller with. The screen size is always, even with the Pro Max or whatever, the screen size is still too small for me.
I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking my instant use case was basically playing the Game Boy Advance games that are on the Switch store. They're the ones that do download on there, which I think, you know, if you can play those with the original GBA, that's a pretty cool way of playing them. I mean, not that the Switch's control mechanisms are too different. And I don't know whether it'd feel weird, like, you know, say you sat there on like a train with a nice table and you got your Switch propped up with the little ledge at the back and you sat there with a Game Boy Advance with the screen kind of off, using it as a controller. It might feel a bit weird. I'd have to try it first. The only downside to this is obviously it is a custom design and these guys basically making them all from, you know, by hand. It does cost $90.
For example, I've got like, I've rooted my TV, my LG TV, and I've got RetroArch on there.
Yeah.
And I use like a Xbox One controller on that through Bluetooth to play on that. Like maybe, you know, using a Game Boy could be quite good. But then, you know, yeah, it depends what you're used to, doesn't it, as your kind of platform.
Yeah, so pre-orders for that are online now. So if you want to get a hold of it, $89 it is the official price. Not cheap, but if you do want to play GBA games using the kind of the original hardware, but on a different device. I'll link that up in this week's show notes as well. Right then, patrons, stay tuned. We have got a couple of extra news stories on the way just for you, because we do that every week on the podcast. We chop the adverts out for the patrons, so that means that we give you a couple of extra stories, including and talk about retro in Japan that apparently could be facing a few problems at the moment. We'll hear about that in just a moment. And also, while we're talking about Patreon, just a little reminder that we have got some of our books available to our Patreon backers. Now, if you weren't familiar with this, this is a book that we did on Kickstarter, probably about getting on for 18 months ago now. And there have been a lot of people that have come to us who missed the initial Kickstarter. It was a compilation of 10 of our favourite interviews with an extra 5 bonus interviews in there as well. Actually, this is kind of, it spiraled a bit further than we initially planned, didn't it? This book, I didn't say it went out of control, but it ended up around, what, 430 pages?
Over 400 pages it ended up being.
It is a beast.
Yeah, it is a beast of a book. And it isn't just, you know, walls and walls of text. There's beautiful artwork in there, photos, you know, all the systems that we talk about in games that we talk about, as well as, you know, all the kind of like blasts from the past with the guests and stuff in there as well. You know, even my mother-in-law read the entire book from front to back, who is not interested in, you know, retro tech or games or anything like that, and said she was thoroughly impressed with it and she couldn't put it down. So
there's a review in the back of the book. Yeah.
And you know what? It was really nice to hear that, you know, somebody wanted to read it. Yes, she's my mother-in-law, so she's going to show interest, but somebody who hasn't got that interest said that it was that good. So somebody who's a listener of the Retro Hour and is into what we do, I think will absolutely love it. And yeah, we've got about 100 or so.
Well, they're going fast.
But they're going fast. Yeah, yeah.
So if you want to get hold of one, we're actually making them available to our patrons for the same price as the Kickstarter backers. So if you want to get hold of one right now, all the details are on our Patreon. You can sign up at theretrohour.com to get first dibs on a Retro Hour book. If you missed the Kickstarter, like we said, though, I will get them while they're hot, because once they're gone, I think that is going to be it, isn't it? You know, it's we need one print run of these. So it is a scarce resource. So all the details to sign up are at theretrohour.com. You get plenty of other perks as well. You get the show ad free, sometimes get it early, also get invited to a hangout as well, which is like a massive Zoom call that we do with all our patrons at the end of each month. So we're doing that next Sunday evening, and that really, you know, the main reason is to support the podcast and make sure that we can keep bringing it out each and every Friday. And of course, new patrons do get inducted into the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, and that is the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame.
And let's welcome in our latest members. A big thank you to Richard Pellett,
Christopher Hurst,
Geordie Santonia,
and Kerry38, who all joined us on Patreon over the last week. We massively appreciate your support, and if you'd like to get involved, all the details are at theretrohour.com. Okay then, so we celebrate the Amstrad CPC's 40th anniversary with this week's special guest, the legend that is Roland Perry. He's coming up on the podcast in just a moment. Before we do that, while we're talking about books, let's take a quick second to give a massive thank you to our longest running sponsor, who we've worked with for over 5 years now. This is Sam and the wonderful guys at Bitmap Books. Now, we've been talking about their incredible new volume, N64, A Visual Compendium. Now, we're all big fans of Bitmap Books volumes anyway. You know, I love their visual compendiums. Some of my favourite books that they do. It is amazing to see that the N64 has finally got its own book as well, because what a system. This is well deserved, don't you think, Joe?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The N64 is just such an iconic system. Probably one of my favourite retro systems. I think it is one of your favourite retro consoles, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Got mine set up next to me right now.
There you go. But so many legendary games on there for a system that didn't actually have that many games release on it. So many legendary games on there, which just kind of blew up for the 3D world. You know, Super Mario 64, GoldenEye, Goemon, Kirby, Ocarina of Time.
I want to stop doing the podcast and go play my N64.
Yeah,
now.
All these games are featured in the N64 Visual Compendium. And as well as obviously the beautiful artwork in there, you always get a nice bite-sized, you know, text about the game as well, which just gives you a little bit of an insight on it. And it's not overwhelming. You know, it's not like, oh, okay, here's 50 pages about GoldenEye. It's, you know, it's a nice bite-sized chunk with all the beautiful artwork, which is perfect for somebody like me.
Yeah, and it's also got a foreword penned by GoldenEye 64 and Perfect Dark's David Doak, the rare legend. Some incredible interviews in there as well with some of the biggest players on the N64 scene. So even, you know, hardware insights in there as well. So, like, you know, the 64DD disk drive peripheral comes in at over 436 pages. So obviously got those massive high standards that they do, the gorgeous paper, the gorgeous print, and that celebrates more than 150 titles that defined the Nintendo 64. So that is available right now. Have a look at it, treat yourself, and check out the rest of their retro gaming catalog as well. Obviously helping our sponsors helps out the podcast too. So their website is bitmapbooks.com, and we thank Sam and the team for their continued support. Okay, then next, we are going to be celebrating 40 years of the Amstrad CPC with our very special guest, the legend that is Roland Perry, is coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And it is wonderful that we can celebrate one of the most iconic British micros of the 1980s that has actually just turned 40 years old this month. So to get the story of it and some more insights into those days at Amstrad, we thought we'd welcome on someone who was the former group tech consultant at Amstrad and was a core part of the Amstrad CPC team. Let's welcome on the wonderful Roland Perry. Hello, Roland.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come on and celebrate the Amstrad CPC's 40th birthday. I mean, does it ever amaze you that there's still interest in these systems and stories four decades later?
Well, it doesn't surprise me that it's become of interest fairly recently, because there's this kind of life cycle of various technologies. For example, vinyl records have suddenly become quite trendy in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years, because what it means is people is, I don't know, 50 somethings who've got a bit of spare time and a bit of spare money start to kind of relive their youth. Some of them buy silly motorbikes and drive around on those, and others think, well, what was the computer I had when I was 10 years old? Maybe I'd like to go on a secondhand market and buy one of those and remind myself of, you know, what it was like back then. So I'm not surprised that it's gone through that life cycle. What I've always been is a slightly disappointed that, particularly on, like, for example, the 30th and 35th anniversaries, nobody was showing the slightest bit of interest, whereas some other platforms, like, for example, the BBC Micro, has managed to kind of continue to have a, you know, interest the whole time.
Well, I think interest is growing. We've started to see a lot of kind of new titles that have come out for the Amstrad in recent years, which is pretty amazing to see. But let's kind of take you back to your early days. We were wondering, you know, you developed an interest in electronics at school. Can you kind of tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that, actually. My interest in electronics, well, there was always a kind of interested in what you call school physics, which is much the same as what engineering is at university. I was interested in that kind of thing. And I went up to London once to a concert when I was about 14, 15 years old. Because I lived in Chelmsford, which is about half an hour out of Liverpool Street. So at the station, I bought a magazine to read off the bookstall, and it was a magazine called Wireless World. Because I thought, oh, that sounds like something might be useful to read. But I found that 90% of what was written about in it was completely incomprehensible. It was all completely over my head. It was all kind of like A-level electronics and things like that. So I just thought to myself, what I'm going to do is I'm going to sit down and learn enough about electronics that I can actually read this publication from cover to cover and understand everything they're saying. So that's how it actually got started. By the time I was, because people did things younger in those days, because I did my O-levels in 4 years, whereas nowadays it takes people 5 years to do GCSEs, which are actually a simpler exam. But by the time I was doing my O-levels and then thinking about going on and doing maths and physics and things as A-levels, I must have only been about 16. And I helped start a electronics and computer club at the school. But it was a boarding school. I was a day pupil at a boarding school. sort of what some people call online a public school, and it's now gone private thanks to Harold Wilson. And we just seems to play around at lunchtimes and after school with whatever we can lay our hands on. And so that's where I really got started with it.
And did that shared knowledge, you know, of computers kind of help you adapt to it quickly?
And the whole thing was just completely self-taught. And the school got a grant from the Ford Foundation, you know, the motor company, whose head office is just down the road, to build a so-called applied cyber centre, which was basically a massive porter cabin in the corner of the playing field. And we would say do these essentially after school club activities there. And because it was a start-up and I was quite interested in it, I was one of the pupils who got involved in basically defining what it was that we do in these clubs, writing all kinds of, my first published journalism was in a magazine we did for the Applied Science Centre all those years ago. And it was just to kind of get everybody, I was interested in involved in computing. I mean, some of the people who were with me all that the way back then, which was in about, 1985 or something like that. Anyway, that can't be right.
Yeah, 75 probably, was it?
Probably, yeah, 75. And there wasn't a lot of, there's very little, by the way, semiconductors in those days. We were playing around with relays and switches and light bulbs and things like that. But it was also a spin-off from the school cadet force. I'm not sure if they have school cadet forces anymore, but we had quite a, well-supported cadet force, and they had two units. Particularly, there was the motor transport, the MT brigade, and they used to drive around the school grounds in beating up cars which they were restoring. And then there was the signals section. And actually, that's where I met William, because he was one of the leading lights of the signal section. And they used to play around with ex-World War II radio receivers and transmitters and do all the strange stuff that radio amateurs do.
Well, let's talk about that, because then before you and William Powell, who, like you said, you met at school, you actually founded a company with him called Ambit International. So tell us a bit about this, and how did that come about, and what was your vision for that company with William?
Well, nowadays you have this thing called gap year.
Yeah.
Well, back then, people on the path that I was on didn't do a gap year because you didn't sit your Cambridge entrance exams until just before Christmas. So there's only like 6 months that you could have a gap. And I chose to do my gap actually at the school rather than going off hiking around the world or whatever, which was all a bit exciting in those days. So I stayed at the school and basically became an intern, sort of temporary teacher, and did even more work trying to set up the Applied Science Centre and everything. I went off to Cambridge to study engineering, and William Powell went off to some other university whose name I forget. It could have been Warwick, but I'm not quite sure. He didn't get on with university life. So he dropped out and went back home. And he was still, however, a very enthusiastic radio amateur. And this is the point at which transistors were becoming viable to make things like what you today call the walkie-talkie for radio amateurs to use. The problem was to build a walkie-talkie using the very latest semiconductors, you need to be able to buy them. And nobody sold them. So he went to Mullard and Phillips and people like that and said, I'd like to buy one of these power transistors to make a radio out of. And they'd say, well, you can't buy one. I mean, all the quantities are 100. All right. And this is all a bit of a kind of a roadblock. So what he decided to do was that he would set up this company literally in his house, where he bought 100, sold 95 or 96 of them through small ads in magazines and things, and then kept the rest for his own fiddling around with. And so I got involved in that. And in fact, I got involved in that pretty early on in my third year at university. And what we did was something which these days, you know, been in marketing far too much in my career, as well as being an engineer. It's what you call product placement. So what we did was we went to monthly periodicals like Practical Wireless and Practical Electronics and said, we'll design this product, which I'm sure your readers would love to build. The first one was actually a metal detector. And what we'll do is we will write you like a 4 or 5 page article for your magazine. We'd like you to take the picture so that we can be the cover project. And then right at the very end of this article, you'll write, we'll have a little box out that says, and if you want to buy all the parts to make one of these yourself, go to Ambit International. And so that was actually quite successful. And I did that all the way through, most of the way through my third year at university. And of course, as soon as I left university, I went and did that full time back down in Brentwood.
Well, when did you become aware of the home micro scene? And I heard you started designing your own systems as well.
Well, that was because when we set up to business, you know, mail order business in Brentwood, and we've been doing that about 2 years, and because we were quite a good customer of a lot of the semiconductor distributors, they'd send their reps around, and the reps would come around and they'd show us all their latest products and say, would you like to buy some of these, you know, sign here, blah, blah, blah. And one day a chap turned up from Motorola, who was a Motorola rep from one of the distributors down in Slough. All the distributors are in Slough because that's the first place where you can set up an office once you've got off a plane from Heathrow. He said, oh, you might be interested in this. It's not really radio or audio, but it's kind of like a logic device, a computing type thing. And what we've got here is a test bed, which is a computer, effectively a computer in a briefcase. So would you be interested in selling those? Well, we weren't interested in selling the whole thing as it was because it was a bit on the expensive side. But I looked at that and I thought, actually, that's a real computer. It was called a MEK something or other, Motorola Development Kit. And I thought, well, actually, there's a proper computer there, because one of the things I didn't mention earlier was all the time I was at school, I was also writing programs for a real computer, which was in the local technical college. And so one of the things at the Applied Science Centre was we used to write programs on punch cards and then in languages like Algol and Fortran and all the rest of it. And I would then take these cards off to the local technical college in the evening on my way home and pick up the previous day's output. And then the day after that, I'd pick up the output for the ones I'd dropped off, you know, so it was so we could actually go round about 3 times a week. So that was why it was also a computer club as well as an electronics club at the Applied Science Centre. So I thought, right, well, actually, I can write programs for this thing in a briefcase, which are going to work just as well as the ones we've been writing for this room full of stuff at the local technical college.
And you didn't have to wait 24 hours to see the output either.
That's right. You could type it in and there it was. Part of the problem was you needed a terminal, because the evaluation kit had on it was a row of LEDs, sort of calculator keypad. So what you had to do really was you either had to golf and spend about £2,000 in today's money buying a computer terminal, or you could lash one up yourself, which is actually what I did. We bought a surplus telex machine and I then converted it into an input-output device for this computer. So that's how we got involved in all of that.
Well, how did you first become aware of Amstrad, and what was your initial involvement with that company?
Well, while I was they'll kind of get the timeline straight here, because I think that's quite important. I worked with my pal William for 2 or 3 years at Ambit in Brentwood, and I got itchy feet and went off and did some other things for about 5 or 6 years. During that period, William made friends with Amstrad, who were not very far away. I mean, we were in Brentwood, they were in Tottenham. It's only about kind of 15 miles down the road. And what he would do is help them out with their projects, which had got into a bit of trouble. Because the people at Amstrad, bless them, they weren't terribly technical. They're incredibly good at marketing and sales and things like that, and having an idea about a product that they wanted to sell, but they weren't really engineers. So a lot of the products which they were halfway through designing would tend to come, you know, just putting it politely, slightly unstuck, and then William would often go and help them sort it out, and then they could put the products into production. Well, that's all going on, you know, completely off my radar. So what happened was that after I got away for, say, this 5 or 6 years, I came back to Ambit to start working there again, because I had, but at that stage, built quite a big computer which was going to automate their entire stock control, ordering, invoicing, mail order business. Actually, almost exactly the same as Screwfix, except they're like 30 years later. So you go into Screwfix and you say, I want one of these and one of these, oh, and maybe the part number's that, and they type it all in, and out comes an invoice, and then somebody goes off and picks it. Well, we were doing that at Ambit back in 1982, 83. Mm. So my job back at Ambit was running that, actually literally built it with my own hands, and I programmed it all, and I installed it, and we converted their entire operation, which by then had about, I don't know, staff of 20 or 30, into a kind of slick mail order operation using the computer. Well, so we were sat there one summer, and the kind of the hobbyist radio electronics business, which is was their core business, has a bit of a slack season in the summer.
Yeah.
Because everyone's off on holiday. They sat on the beach in Spain, not trying to build themselves a ham radio. So we always used to do our annual stock check in July or August, because we had very few orders coming in, and so we didn't have much else to do. Whereas obviously in kind of December, January, February, we were flat out delivering stuff to people who were sat at home indoors out of the pouring rain. So we were sat there doing our stock check one Saturday morning, and Bob Watkins from Amstrad, who's their technical director, turned up with his computer under his arm and rather glum look on his face, and said, "Oh, this is our latest project that's come a bit unstuck. Can you help us out with this?" And that was and that's been documented in pretty much all of the books on Amstrad.
And that was the CPC project, right? And was that already underway? And what challenges was it facing? And what kind of steps did you take to initially turn it round?
Well, the main challenge it faced was timescale. A product like that, or a project like that, usually takes about 18 months from beginning to end to do the design work. You know, it's quite a lengthy process. And they were already about 15 months through the 18 months that they're allocated to do that, when the original designers decided that they were going to give up and go home. Amstrad had a business model. Well, they actually had dozens and dozens of different items for sale. Most of them almost, you know, have never really hit the public consciousness, because a lot of them weren't sold as Amstrad things, but they used to sell blue jeans and electric kettles and all kinds of stuff. So they were, to some extent, a general import-export company. every year they decided that they would have a flagship product for Christmas. And it would always be a completely new product, complete surprise to the market. And in previous years, they'd had, for example, the twin cassette deck tower systems, right? And then in years after the CPC, they had Sky dish receiver combinations. One year they had a camcorder. There's the emailer, which is, although it's a computer, it's not really a games computer. They had the PCW word processor, which again, it's not a games computer. And then the year after that, we had PC clones, which again are not games computers and aren't really even the same as the PCW word processor. So every year they'd have a flagship product, which they wanted to put into the shops for Christmas. Now, to have a product in the shops for Christmas, for people to buy for Christmas, it needs to be shipping in volume in about September. All right? So, because nobody buys anything in July, August, because again, they're all sat on the beach in Spain, but September, they're coming back and thinking, oh, what shall I buy the family for Christmas? So, to get something in the shops for September, you need to be producing them in the spring because they come over on a ship. It takes quite a long time. And to be producing something in the spring, you need to finish the design by the very latest the previous December. And to finish the design in December, you need to have started the design maybe 6 or 9 months before that. So it's quite a long, drawn-out process. And one of the things, well, that particular year, what they wanted their product for 1984 was going to be a home computer. Okay. Why did they pick a home computer? Well, there you go. It was just a kind of like a trendy thing at the time. So I think they slightly underestimated the fact that you can't design a home computer in 6 or 9 months. Because it's from scratch, because it just simply takes longer than that. So they contracted a couple of guys who'd done some of their previous projects to design a home computer, and they went off and did their best, but came back in, I suppose, in July, maybe early August, saying, well, I know you said this has to be finished by September, but, you know, we're completely stuck. You know, we're simply not going to be able to do this. And so they just walked off the job. So that left Amstrad with a product that they were trying to launch in 12 months' time, which was basically, you know, just a pile of junk at that point. So they came to us at Ambit and said, okay, you guys know a bit about computers. Could you rescue some other projects of ours in the past, mainly kind of audio wireless type products like CB radios and things? Could you do anything with this computer? And I said, well, as it happens, I've been playing around with these things for the last 15 years. So I think I probably could do it if you wanted me to. And I said, well, and how long, at that point, I wasn't completely up to speed with what the timescale was. And I said, well, how long have we got to do this? And they said, well, I don't know, until about the second week in December. Which part of the question is, well, December which year? And they said, well, December this year, of course. And that point, it kind of thinking, well, nobody's ever really done that before. But the challenge seemed interesting. And so what I said was, well, I'll tell you what, this does sound interesting. I know you're serious about doing this. And if I give you a design, you really will go into production with it and you really will sell a couple of 100,000 of them. So that's rather useful, because at the time there were about 100 other small British designed home computers sloshing around, of which probably 90% never made it to market, and of the rest of them they only ever sold about 5,000 in their entire lifetime because they didn't understand manufacturing and distribution and marketing and things like that. And I thought, well, actually we've got a chance here to be involved in a project which I know is going to get all of that support from head office to actually put it in the shops and sell it to people. So it's worth putting in the effort. So I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I'll spend a week. I won't charge you. I'll just spend a week. I'll go around to some of my friends in the computer industry and ask them if they'd be interested in doing this impossible thing, which is designing this computer for you in 3 months when it usually takes at least a year. So I just, you know, did a road trip and I went round and I saw people who, a lot of these people I'd known when I was at Cambridge, and a lot of them had kind of hung around Cambridge in the computer industry there at the time, which was sort of dominated by Sinclair, which was in King's Parade in Cambridge, and Acorn, which is just down the road from them. So I went round, I went to see some ex, or not even ex, I went to see some people who were still working for Sinclair, who were still working for Acorn, who were subcontractors to Sinclair and Acorn. I also went to some totally other people who I happened to know had been involved in home computer projects before, and talked to all of them and said, well, are you interested in doing this project? Well, my biggest problem wasn't my lack of enthusiasm or commitment to anything like that, but I was not allowed to tell them who my client was. And so if I turned up and said, well, my client is the BBC, and they, you know, when this thing's finished, it's going to be called Run BBC Micro, and it's going to be on television, and you're all going to be very famous for the rest of your life, they might have been more interested in it. Whereas all I could say was, well, I can't tell you who my client is because they swore me to secrecy. You just have to trust me that it's someone who I think you need to take seriously. And they were all a bit kind of, sounds a bit dodgy to us. And so one of the reasons why I thought up the name Arnold to stick on the original computer, was only a keyboard or something, nothing inside it, I touted around, was because that was channeling Arnold Weinstock, who at the time was the chief of GEC. And I thought that without actually saying it, some people might think, oh, maybe he's doing this for some branch of GEC that's going to produce a home computer.
Right.
Because they're a, you know, sufficiently serious company who you might want to work for, and more to the point, who, if you did work for them, you'd expect to get paid, which was very important. So towards the end of the week, I was drawing a lot of blanks. Everyone's saying, well, we believe you, and sounds like an interesting project. But first of all, we simply can't do it by Christmas, even if we dropped everything. And then we can't drop everything because we've got all sorts of other things for other clients on at the moment. So we can't drop all their projects. So drawing a blank left, right, and centre. Well, someone absolutely sort of last chance saloon on someone's recommendation was to go down to Dorking and talk to the guys at MEJ and Locomotive, both of whom, it turns out, were a bit of a loose end at the time, and said to them, would you like to do this? And they said, well, we haven't got anything else to do, so all right, you're on. So we sat in a pub in Dorking and drew a spec up on the back of a beer mat or something. And I then went back to the office, telexed off to Amstrad on the Friday, I think. And Monday morning, I got the telex back saying, great, go ahead.
Wow.
So it was all kind of, the whole thing was a real whirlwind. But what we knew was that if Amstrad sent you a fax saying, do it, then they expected you to go off and do it. They didn't expect you to turn around and say, oh, actually, we changed our mind over the weekend. But more importantly, that they were serious about it, that they would support you, they would fund the development, they would put it into production, and maybe one day you might become slightly famous.
That's an incredible story, though. I mean, the fact that it went basically from, you know, just that chance meeting to getting the system designed and then the specs and everything just in those 3 months, like, and even today, that would be incredible, never mind 40 years ago. So, I mean, talking about, you know, speccing the system, what was kind of the initial specification that you came up with, and what were the aims of it, and how do you go about, you know, balancing the cost with the performance as well? I imagine that was all things you had to take into account.
Well, actually, that bit's quite... That's quite straightforward, because a computer like that is just a set of building blocks. So you can have a processor, whichever one it is. It doesn't really matter if it's a Z8 or a 6502 or whatever. That's just a processor that costs you about $2. And then you need 64K of RAM because at that stage in the market, it had to have 48K wasn't enough, and 128K you couldn't do anything useful with. So there's two fixed points already. The graphics modes, again, are fixed points. You know, you want at least 16 colors and in at least what nowadays we call VGA resolution and so on and so forth. So actually, there isn't much to argue about in terms of specification. It's all pretty obvious. And you want a keyboard, and we already had the keyboards because Amstrad already designed that, waiting for someone to come up with a circuit board to put inside it. They already decided they were going to have a separate monitor power supply so that whoever was using the computer wasn't having to borrow the family's TV in the living room. And that was a very important bit of the marketing was, well, what you buy from us, you can take up to your kid's bedroom or wherever, and it's autonomous. And you can carry on watching Coronation Street while they're playing on the computer. So actually, there weren't that many parameters. And so all you have to do is call a bill of materials. You just add up the cost of a processor chip and 64K of memory, a sound chip and a graphics controller, which is an industry standard one, and so on and so forth. And it comes out at less than the magic number, that's great. If it comes out at more than the magic number, you have to look at it and say, well, what can you possibly trim off this so that it still works and doesn't stop working? Because this is one of the problems with the Sinclair QL, actually. They went through exactly the same exercise. They got a bill of materials which was too high, and they started chopping bits off it, and they chopped so much off it that it didn't work anymore. Mm. And the rest, they say, is history.
Well, when you were, coming up with the kind of the target user in mind, I imagine when you're designing a system, you've got to think about what it's going to be used for. And the Amstrad always, famously had some of the best graphics of, those mid-80s micros. I mean, were you designing this system then with, like, games front of center in mind, or were you maybe thinking of, people doing programming on it or business? What was kind of the target market for it that you were thinking of?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of disagreement internally about this. Amstrad wanted it to be a games computer, effectively just a games console with a keyboard on it, that with ASCII keyboard on it. I felt that what it also needed to be was much more like a affordable BBC Micro. In other words, something with a good basic where you could learn to program on it, because the reason why parents particularly bought their children the BBC Micro wasn't so they could play games on it, even if that's actually all they ever did, but so they could learn about computers and turn themselves into engineers in this newly emerging technology. So I was much more at the BBC Micro end of the spectrum than just a games console that happens to have a rather big keyboard on it. But we could do both at the same time, so it didn't matter.
It was that why kind of user manuals and documentation were so important to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I felt that what you needed to be able to do was get the computer home, open it up, read the instruction manual, which is much more than where you just plug everything in and hope for the best. It actually taught you about computers and how to program and what was actually going on under the bonnet. The 464 didn't have an awful lot of time to write the manual, but by the time we got to the 6128, the manual was about three times the size and really was just how to program computers book, just as much as what does a CPC 6128 do?
Well, obviously, any computer platform needs software. It lives and dies by its software range generally. And in 1984, you and William headed up Amsoft, which was a subsidiary of Amstrad that was focused on basically developing an infrastructure for software and services for the systems. So how did you initially go about developing the software and putting that in place?
Amsoft was essentially the user club, because what we understood was that in order to create this kind of family of CPC users, you couldn't just stick a computer in Dixon's and say, there you go, get on with it. But it needed a magazine, which we had. So we produced our own in-house magazine, although, of course, I don't know, I lost count, but there must have been at least half a dozen independent titles started up after that. You needed enough games on a rack next to it to say, well, okay, I'm not just taking this computer home, maybe with a couple of free games thrown in, but here's a catalogue with another, you know, 50 or 100 games in it, so I could see that I could buy one of those when I can afford it, so on and so forth. So AmSoft's job was to run the user club, produce the magazine, and help software houses market their software under the AmSoft brand, because what each software house had to decide was, okay, so I'm going to convert my Spectrum game or even write them from scratch. I mean, Roamland in Time was written in, you know, from scratch by a bloke, you know, sat in the corner of my office. So what they've got to decide is, once we've got this game, are we going to market it under our own brand name and take our chances in the market, or are we going to effectively license it to Amstrad to sell under the AmSoft brand, because they've got a catalogue, they've got a distribution channel, and we might even end up making more money, even though we're just acting as a wholesaler to Amstrad.
Well, it's great that you mentioned a Roland there as well, because that was the system's mascot, and there was 9 games that actually came out over the years. And it's a character that was kind of named after you. So what was the story there, and what was it like kind of being the mascot?
Well, this is a Lord Sugar's joke at the time. You know, we basically got the very first 2 games that ever appeared were from Indiscomp, who were eventually our Spanish distributor. And one was Roland in the caves, the other was Roland on the ropes. And they both had this little character, although they didn't look anything like one another, but they both had a little kind of character jumping up and down and doing all sorts of stuff. And he, you know, Will Sugar just thought, oh, got a little character jumping up and down, all this energy and everything, let's call him Roland.
Nice.
And so from then onwards, any game that we had sort of anything to do with publishing that had a little energetic character in it, might or might not have got branded as a Roland game.
Did that ever help, you know, turning up in meetings with your name, you know?
Not really, no.
Well, obviously, I mean, you know, that era, the mid-1980s, it was rife with competition in the home computer market. So how did Amstrad go about positioning the CPC against, you know, competitors like, obviously, the ZX Spectrum, I imagine, was the big one, but also we had the Commodore 64 in the more premium end of the market. How did Amstrad kind of fit in?
Well, I think the answer is distribution. So what Amstrad did was a deal with Dixon's so that you could, so there were CPCs in every Dixon's shop in every high street in the country, and also in Rumbelows and a few other stores, you know, whose names are lost in the depths of time now. And that's what you need. You need people to be wandering down the high street on a sort of wet, rainy Saturday afternoon thinking, what am I going to buy the kids for Christmas? And they need to be able to see it in the window, lots of flashy advertising and point-of-sale material and things like that. And that's what none of the other competition did. They just stuck small ads in the back of magazines and things like that and hoped for the best. So Sinclair was also notorious for the unreliability of its product. And as far as I was aware, something like 20% of all the Spectrums that they shipped didn't work and had to come back to be fixed or reworked or repaired or something like that. No retailer can cope with that kind of attrition. So we had to do a big job with all the retailers Bunks was the worst, actually, or maybe the best, depending on their point of view. They had really, really fierce buyers who insisted that only things which really did work would get onto their shelves in Boots, and to persuade them that this was a product that wasn't going to break down, that it had, you know, at least 99.5% reliability out of the box, and so on and so forth. And we just concentrated on that when none of the other retailers did. The computer manufacturers did. Things like the Commodore 64 did have a certain amount of retail distribution, but it was just so much more expensive, and also by then getting a bit long in the tooth. So we just kind of leapfrogged over it, I suppose. I mean, they still sold loads of machines, but we were quite happy selling all the ones we could manufacture. So, you know, there's no kind of real argument there.
You know, the system was quite powerful, and there were a lot of simple ports of like Spectrum software and stuff. Recently, we've seen loads of developers, you know, creating new Amstrad titles and CPC titles, and they look absolutely awesome. Do you think it was a bit of an untapped resource at the time?
Well, I think the issue was that, as I said earlier, we put together a computer out of standard building blocks. And so we said to software writers, well, this is what a Z80 does. This is what the standard graphics chip does. This is what we expect the computer to be able to do reliably all day long. So they went off and wrote games based on that. Now, years and years later, people are beginning to find things which that silicon does, which were never documented, which result in, as you say, actually quite spectacularly better games. But nobody was prepared to take that risk 40 years ago, so they were designed for the machine that we were shipping, not the machine that had benefited from 35 years of reverse engineering.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, people had a lot of time to learn the hardware inside out now, I guess.
And the games that are coming out, I was really surprised. Last summer, I went to a couple of events in Spain. It's important. Spain's important because the CPC was pretty much the only computer that anybody bought in Spain at the time, because Spectrum had no market presence. BBC Micro had no market presence. Commodore 64 was far too expensive. And so we had the CPC there, and just so many people who got a CPC for Christmas in 1984-1985, because that was pretty much the only thing on the market. And those people have now gone on, a lot of them have now gone on to become programmers and things like that, and they're so grateful for having that introduction into computing. And you know, I think it's that's also part of this retro thing, that the Spaniards who are fueling this current enthusiasm in new games and writing dozens and dozens of, you know, they even have like an Oscars, like a mini Oscars over there for the best new CPC game. They're doing that because it's now, they're programming at the age of 40, 45, the computer they had when they were a teenager. And that's what makes it so special.
So that is it for part one of our chat with Roland Perry. And of course, there is lots more to come on the show next week, including we'll hear about the Sinclair takeover, how things change at Amstrad when the Spectrum came in-house, developing later models of the CPC range, and some prototypes that never saw the light of day. Part two of our Amstrad CPC 40th birthday special will be on the podcast next week. If you can't wait that long, though, and you want to hear the entire thing right now, we have got the full interview on our Patreon page. So you can join right now, become a patron on our website at theretrohour.com, and we'll see you next week.